Service begins. First of all, if you get a chance today, while you're in the social hall, take a look at the logos that we have posted, a choice of logos for you to vote on for the church in mid-April. And we want to also thank all the volunteers who participated in Family Promise this week. We had a very successful week with one family. And we really are in gratitude for the volunteers who stepped forward so graciously to spend their time.
Love made flesh has risen, And we are reminded once again that evil will never prevail. The divine spirit cannot be destroyed. Almighty God of many names, who teaches us through the story of Jesus Christ that we are born into salvation and the life eternal, grant that we who celebrate with joy the triumph over death may be raised from all that would wrap us in darkness and dismay. Come and let us worship here together. Please take just a moment to say hello or to introduce yourself to your neighbor. Come on. If you want to use him, make sure to let him know we're going to play a 3-1 full time and then we'll start. So the pianist will play a 3-1 full time. Yeah.
For holy days on which we recall the old stories, we light the flame. For Passover, which reminds us of the courage and strength of those seeking freedom in the past, we light the flame. For Easter, which reminds us that love is our greatest challenge, we light the flame. For gathering today in this sacred space, we light the flame. For the opportunity to be together as a community, to remember the past, to plan for our future, to be alive in our present, we light the flame. Please rise in body or spirit and join me in singing our first hymn, number 29, Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee. And our pianist will play through one time and then we'll join him. Thank you. Good morning and welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we surround this community with the spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Laura Levenhagen, and I'm the worship associate for this morning's service. We are a welcoming congregation and hope that all visitors, friends, members, wherever they are on life's journey and whatever their backgrounds, will find a lasting home here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in our social hall after the service. And while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Today's order of service contains announcements of upcoming church activities, and we look forward to everyone joining in. Like and follow Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church on Facebook in order to get ongoing information about activities, and check out our webpage at lcuuc.org to stay current on services and events. Please take a moment to silence any electronics you may have brought with you today. And again, welcome to everyone here this morning. We are so pleased that you have chosen to celebrate and worship today with us.
One of the ways that we care for our community is by contributing to local food pantries, both financially and by giving non-perishable food items that we donate every month. So if you have items to share, please bring them forward or have a child bring them forward for you, and I invite the children to stay up front and enjoy a story. The joy of technology means that I have to read the Kindle on the computer this morning. It helps if your computer doesn't shut down while you're sitting there. All right, we are in business. So our story today is called An Easter Bonnet for Lily, and it was written and illustrated by Jody Stone. Once upon a time, in a land named Tulip, bunnies were hopping around and getting ready for Easter. And every bunny in the land had a specific job, so these were not lazy bunnies, these were determined bunnies. Some bunnies painted eggs, some weaved straw into baskets, some helped train new recruits in hopping and other duties. This time of the year was always exciting for all of the bunnies except for one. Lily was the newest bunny recruit, and she wasn't very good at it. You see, she had trouble with everything she tried. Ever since she was a baby, she was special. Her long, floppy ears were the talk of everybody in town. She didn't feel special. Her parents told her she was the most beautiful bunny ever. She had brown fur and big green eyes, and she was very pretty. But every time she looked in the mirror, all she could see was those long, floppy ears swinging back and forth in front of her face. She sat at the window and she watched all the other bunnies up and down the street, ladybugs carrying eggs, toadstool seats were set up for the night's events. Tulip always had a parade on the evening of Easter to help the bunnies get in the spirit. But Lily felt sad because she knew she just couldn't do anything with those big old ears. She would just be in the way. Across town, kids were getting ready for Easter, too. One little girl got her Easter dress out and matching bonnet. She heard about plans for an egg hunt and a basket filled with goodies. Savannah had always loved the holidays, but Easter was her favorite. Her older sisters, Brooke and Alexis, also loved the day. They were usually too busy for playing, but Savannah knew on days like Easter, she'd get time to play with them. Savannah was staring at her bonnet when her sister walked in, and Brooke said, "Hey, Munchkin, you got your dress picked out?" "Yeah, but I think my bonnet is too plain." And there she is with her plain pink bonnet. Brooke looked the bonnet over and sat down next to Savannah. "Let's add some sparkles and a ribbon, and then it'll be perfect." Sparkles and sequins and bows all made their home on the little girl's pink bonnet. And she started to smile. She could not wait to show off her fancy hat and dress. Like the bunnies in Tulip, every year Savannah's family made Easter preparations. A big Easter egg hunt. Her parents were setting up tables and chairs. They set up hopscotch and displayed bubbles. "Can I help set the tables up, Mom?" Savannah said. "Tables are ready, but go up your sister." "Can I help you, Brooke?" "I'm done. Go help Alexis." Well, Alexis was done too, and Savannah was sad. She loved to dress up fancy. Easter was perfect, and she walked across the yard to her favorite spot in the garden and started to look around for ladybugs and frogs and anything else interesting. Back in the land of Tulip, Lily decided to go for a walk too. The Easter carriage was back in its place, and Lily decided it would be the perfect spot to hide out. She climbed in, and without realizing how tired she was, she leaned over for just a minute, and the next thing she knew, she was sound asleep. Lily's long ears flopped out to the side, and they pressed the go button on the carriage. And before she could blink, she woke up somewhere else. She was in a world she'd only read about, in a garden with humans. She made her way out of the carriage and got close to a toadstool, thinking she could hide. But there was a little girl there. Savannah was sitting there in the garden waiting for her. "Hello there, Bunny. You weren't here before." "Hi," Lily said. "You talked! Bunnies don't talk. Am I dreaming?" "You're not dreaming. My name's Lily." Savannah talked to Lily and was so happy to have somebody to talk to. Lily said, "My ears are too big. Look." Savannah said, "I'm too little to do anything to help at Easter. Look, that's why I'm sitting here." They started to laugh and tell stories, and before they knew it, Savannah brought out a basket with her favorite bows in it. "Lily, I know you think you can't do anything because of your ears, but I might be able to help." Savannah took off her pretty pink bonnet that she had spent all morning decorating, and she cut two big holes in it. Then she pulled up and folded up Lily's ears and put them through the holes in the bonnet, one on each side. Lily couldn't believe her eyes. Her ears weren't dragging on the ground anymore or flopping in the wind. They were standing right up like every other bunny's. She was beautiful. Life would never be the same. Lily was determined to be the best Easter bunny ever. And in her new hat, she knew she could do it. In one day, she'd helped a friend, talked to a bunny, found a solution to a problem. Savannah felt wonderful, too. She had lacked the confidence before to help with the Easter eggs or set the tables, and she gave up when everybody told her they were done. But now she realized she was able to do things all by herself, too. So after saying goodbye to her new friends, Savannah took her basket of bows and sequins and went to help her sisters make their hats for Easter. She added bows and ribbons to the basket. She added sequins to the bowl that held the eggs. Then she added sequins to the eggs. They were fabulous. Lily made her way back to the carriage. She went back to Tulip and told her friends how she had found the confidence to talk to a little girl. She realized that she needed to tell them that you can always find a solution to a problem. And she showed off her new bonnet and how good her ears looked in it. She went and helped prepare Easter and knew that her life would never be the same. You see, it's important to accept who you are and never let anything hold you back. Everyone has special talents, and it's up to you to follow through. Follow your dreams, no matter how bumpy your path, how big your sequins, or how floppy your ears. And this is Lily and Savannah saying goodbye. Thank you all for listening to my Easter story. If I could have my lantern bearer. May the light and love of our chalice lead you today and every day. If you all would help me in singing the children to their classrooms, the song is called For You Shall Go Out, and the words are written in your order of service. Easter is one of the few times a year where I forego my usual joke at the offering. Easter is a gift to us, a reminder to us that we are worthy simply by virtue of being born, and that we have already been given the gifts of grace and forgiveness. May we always give generously in return. The morning offering will now be given and received. our thanks for these gifts given and received for the life and the work of this community. This is the time in our service where we share together our joys and our sorrows. We do this in several ways. Before the service, you can always come up and silently light a candle at the candle table. During the service, we speak aloud together and we light candles. So would anyone who has a joy or a sadness to share, please raise your hand and the usher will bring you a microphone. And I'd like to light the first candle today for a joy. It is Tony Casper's birthday. So where are you, Tony? Happy birthday.
Hi, this is Paula. I'm so joyful to be here today, but I also have to share a big joy. Go Badgers.
Now you know I'm from Kentucky, Paula. Anybody else? So we light our last candle today for all of those joys and all of those sadnesses that are deeply held, but which we have not named here today.
Our first reading is called Discovering a Living Resurrection by Reverend Meg Riley. For much of my life, including my years attending a Christian seminary, the resurrection was an abstraction to me. I tended to think more about daffodils, eggs, springtime around Easter time, more than I did about a dead man in a tomb, rolling back a stone and walking out. All of that changed the year I interned at a small storefront church in Roxbury, Massachusetts. The church, housed in a Marcus Garvey community center, was a lively gathering for the homeless, jobless, those struggling with addiction, the Boston Detox brought a bus each week, and people with AIDS. Most of the men and many of the women had spent time in jail. During the year I was there, over a dozen young men who were affiliated with the congregation were shot, and many of them were killed. Though the church was quite multicultural, the senior minister preached the kind of black liberation theology that Reverend Jeremiah Wright was so ridiculed for during the 2008 presidential campaign. For me, as a white middle-class girl, it was challenging to be so completely out of my element. Many of the cultural references were lost on me, and not only did I not share a culture or a class with most of the people there, it was, above all, the Christianity that bewildered me. It resembled nothing I had experienced or learned about in my seminary classes. One day, I remember walking home, kicking rocks and grumbling to myself. The seminary should have called it the White New Testament class. This is a whole different religion than I ever learned about. The weekly interpretation of Scripture left me stunned, excited, and often bewildered that the stories I had heard for so long could be explained in such different ways. But here's the truth. The religious story I was part of in Roxbury was far more compelling and interesting than the one I had learned about in a white middle-class seminary. And it made a lot more sense. I began to see why Christianity had never really worked for me as a religion. It was meant to be a survival code for the poor and the marginalized, not a cloak of entitlement and sanctity for the privileged. In Roxbury, we took communion every week, and every week, the people, led the central part of the service by saying, "On the night Jesus was betrayed, he offered bread to his beloved people and said, 'Take this and eat in remembrance of me.' Now we remember all of those people who are betrayed, who are hurt and killed as they stand for justice and stand with the poor and the marginalized. We eat this bread in honor of them all." And then people would call out the names of people, either people that they knew or Oscar Romero, Mahatma Gandhi, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, all of those who had been betrayed in their work for justice. This sense of God as the unkillable spirit, despite all abuse and oppression and suffering, provided meaning and continuity in a community that could count on little of it. Easter then became the annual marking of the triumph of the oppressed. No matter how it might appear on the outside, no matter how mighty the powers against him, Jesus could not be killed. That fact, and that is a fact, held together the lives of people who struggled every day to roll boulders off of their own life force, boulders of racism, poverty, violence, and addiction. Ultimately, it was not in church or reading scripture that I witnessed and came to understand the resurrection. It was in the lives of the gathered people. These people, who had every reason to give up and live hopeless, bitter lives, they instead tapped into the vein of life that is made a way out of no way for oppressed people throughout the ages. The resurrection made itself visible to me in the lives of imperfect people struggling against all odds to live generous, meaningful lives, creating together a community of love and care and spiritual strength. Until that time, it was as if Jesus was an uncle away in the army. I had never met him, but his picture was on the mantelpiece, and people talked about him fondly. In Roxbury, I came to know the living Jesus. That lived experience has given me strength and comfort ever since, and makes the grandest fields of daffodils seem tiny and dull in comparison. Here ends the first reading.
Please join me in a silent moment of meditation or prayer.
Our second reading is Being the Resurrection by Reverend Victoria Weinstein. The stone has got to be rolled back from the tomb again and again every year. Roll up your sleeves. He is not coming back, you know. He is not coming back. unless it is we who rise for him. We who lay healing hands on the reviled and rejected like he did on his behalf. We who rage for righteousness in his insistent voice. We who love the sinner, even knowing that the sinner is no farther off than our own heartbeat. He will not be back to join us at the table to share God's extravagant banquet, God's love feast. All are invited, come as you are. And so it is you and I who must feast for him, must say the grace and break the bread and pass it to the left, and dish up the broiled fish or pour the wine and pass it to the right, and treat each one so tenderly as though just this morning she or he made the personal effort to make it back from heaven or from hell, but certainly from death, to be by our side. Because if by some miracle, and why not a miracle, he did come back, wouldn't he want to see us like this? Wouldn't it be a miracle to live for just one day so that if he did, by some amazing feat, come riding into town, he could look around and say, this is what I meant. And we could say, it took us a long time, but we finally figured it out. Oh, let us live to make it so. You are the resurrection and the life. Here ends the second reading. Please rise, embody your spirit, and join in singing number 38, Morning Has Broken, and Nancy will play through first.
Bethlehem lies in what today would be the central West Bank, about 6 miles south of Jerusalem. Over 2,000 years ago, a baby boy named Jesus was born, of the lineage of King David, born to a little Jewish girl and her older husband. The young girl came from wealth and privilege. Her husband was a skilled carpenter, and the little boy was different. From the beginning, he was different. Today, he might have been called a genius or a savant. He understood, implicitly understood, Jewish law. As soon as it was explained to him, he got complexities that older men couldn't quite get. He understood the words of great Jewish and Eastern teachers. He studied in the time, from the time he was little, and by the time he was 13 and officially an adult, he could debate and dispute with his own teachers, with the priests. He was probably a little frightening. Someone so young and so wise. A very few written stories do exist. He was accepted into religious discussions of grown men, not just tolerated, but accepted. According to the infancy gospel of Thomas, there are some more magical stories. He made his toys come to life and fly away. Another boy bumped him and he cursed him. Struck the neighbors blind and then healed them again. A child learning how to be an adult. And then he disappeared from the written records. No mysticism, no literalism. He just disappeared. The years of his life from 13 to 30 are a blank. Scholars assume he worked with his father. He became a carpenter. The Jews of the time had begun to be a fragmented people. Cosmopolitan and wealthy Greek-influenced Jews and rural Aramaic-speaking Jews, very different. Essenes studied and prayed in the wilderness. Zealots fought for public recognition. The Sanhedrin were the Jewish Supreme Court, the Sadducees, the aristocrats, the Pharisees, the middle class. The poorest Jews either championed the Pharisees or gave up and began to intermarry with Romans and Greeks and Egyptians, with followers of Sabel and Dagon and Mithras and the Greek and Roman gods. Judaism had begun to get soft around the edges, divided into warring camps. In order for the house of Israel not to disappear, consumed by the immensity of the Roman Empire, a Messiah had to come. A leader. Some said a warrior king. Others said, maybe not. A leader to break the people free of the chains of prophecy and custom and law. A leader to see a new way, to ask new questions, to save his people, a Messiah, to create a new covenant based not on the things that were driving them apart, interpretations of the law and arguments, but on affirmation and love and commonality. At around 30, Jesus reappeared, suddenly teaching and preaching as he walked with his followers across Israel, up and down the Jordan River Valley, around the Sea of Galilee. His older cousin John was already there. They had never met. John was a wild man, out in the wilderness, wide-eyed, baptizing followers in the Jordan, screaming that the Messiah was coming. The end of days was upon them. They met for the first time, and Jesus asked to be baptized. John knew who he was. And even John, the wild-eyed holy man, said, no. No. This isn't for me. You should be baptizing me. I can't do this. And Jesus said, yes, you can. Baptize me now. I'll baptize you later with the Holy Spirit, with the breath of God. But at this moment, baptize me with water. And John did. I cannot imagine the terror that this radical Jew felt on seeing someone who he believed to be the warrior king who had been born. And stories of miracles started to circulate. Over and over, wherever there were prophecies about what would happen with the coming of the Messiah, Jesus started to fulfill them, sometimes to the letter. For those of you who are humanist or atheist, sometimes in ways that only a scholar of the law could have, someone who knew every piece of the prophecy and what it meant and what it implied. This man, this walking rabbi, began to reshape his world. Crowds started to gather to hear him speak. And in a time where radical preachers were more likely to have rocks thrown at them, people came for entertainment to watch these men with wild eyes and wild hair scream about the end of times. But that wasn't what was happening here. People came to listen. They repeated back to each other what he had said if they didn't hear. They weren't throwing rocks. They weren't throwing dung, which was their other favorite hobby at the time. They were listening. And Rome began to pay attention. On Sunday that is now called Palm Sunday, he rode triumphantly into Jerusalem. The crowd laid their coats and palm branches across the road so that he would not ride on dust. He came riding a donkey and leading a horse to show that he came in peace, not war, in accordance with prophecy after prophecy. He knew that he had angered Rome, that he had angered the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court. He knew that the preaching he had done about there being another way would not be well received. But the people heard it. The poor, the sick. On Wednesday, he knew that the end was coming. And he asked his friends to go with him to the garden at Gethsemane to pray. Wipe the myths out of your mind for a minute and think. This was a young rabbi, a young man, early 30s. He was frightened. He knew he was taking on the entirety of Rome and the Jewish people. And whether he was doing it because he was the Messiah or because he was a man who wanted his people to live, in that moment, he was a terrified man who said to his friends, "Come with me to the garden. Pray with me for just a little while." And they went and they sat down, and he walked away from them to go deeper in the garden. And he prayed. And the word he used was Abba, which isn't, "Oh, Father." It's the equivalent of "Dad," "Daddy." It's the only time he uses it. "Dad, take this away from me. If it's possible, take this away. Don't let this happen. But if it has to, I understand. Dad." And he went back to his friends, and they had all fallen asleep. And he said to him, "Can't you watch with me for even a little while? Can't you forget just for a minute that I know it's not you, you're not the one dying, but stand with me just for a minute." And he went away to pray again, and he said, "Please, let this pass from me." And they fell asleep again. And when he came out, he said, "Can't you watch with me? Can't you stand with me for a little while? Stand with the dying. Stand with the poor, with the frightened. Stand with the accused." His friend Judas, who he had had dinner with just the night before, sold him to the Romans. Judas wasn't a rotten guy. He believed that Jesus was that warrior king, that if they came to get him, he was going to take up arms. Jesus was not a zealot. Judas was. It was a political group. He believed the battle would begin and Jesus would be triumphant. So he sold him to the Romans. And he led a group of them to the garden where Jesus was praying. And he kissed Jesus on the cheek to identify him. He was taken before the Sanhedrin, Jewish High Council, and accused not of injury to Rome, but of blasphemy, a religious offense. And on Thursday, he was taken to Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea. Pilate found him innocent. He said, he hasn't done anything to Rome, and I am a Roman. But Pilate feared Jewish unrest. Rather than make a final decision, he called out to the crowd, "Who will you have freed? What will you have done?" And the same crowd who had welcomed him with palms and robes said, "Crucify him. Crucify him." On Friday, Jesus was beaten and whipped and tormented. The soldiers made a crown of thorns and forced it onto his head because someone had called him King of the Jews. You had to carry your own cross to the crucifixion because the Romans would not carry it for you. He was so weak that he couldn't carry it. And a man named Simon of Cyrene was pulled out of the crowd because he was a very large man and forced to carry the cross. They crucified him at Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. This was where they routinely killed people. Like any criminal, he was offered a drink of wine and myrrh to dull the pain, and he refused. Spiked through the wrists and ankles, he was crucified between two common thieves, and his followers ran away. When they were asked, "Didn't I see you with that man Jesus?" they said, No, that wasn't me. That wasn't me standing with that criminal. Wasn't me. I don't want to get any of that stuff on me. Wasn't me. The inscription above his head read, "The King of the Jews." He hung for 6 hours. As he was first dying, the soldiers at the foot of the cross gambled to see who would win his robe, which was a normal practice. And the people came by to heckle. He was able to speak to his mother and to John, and he cried out to God, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" According to the writings, at 3 o'clock it got dark and a storm came in. And a little later he said the second to last discernible thing, "It is finished." A few breaths later he said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." An earthquake shook the ground, ripping the curtains from the temple in two from top to bottom. And the book of Matthew says, "The earth shook and the rocks split, the tombs split open, and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised." Roman soldiers wandered back to check on Jesus. Can you imagine the job of walking that row of crosses? When they got to him, he was already dead. They used a spear to pierce his side to make sure he was gone. There was nowhere to put him because he was poor. So a wealthy man named Joseph of Arimathea came and took him down himself and put him in his own tomb. And early on Sunday morning, the women who had come with him from Galilee, Mary Magdalene and Mary his mother, went to the tomb to get the body out and clean it. They had to wait through the length of the Sabbath. But on Sunday they went carrying grave linens, and the tomb was empty. The massive stone which had been in front to keep anyone from stealing the body was rolled away. The body was gone. He had risen. The purpose of the crucifixion was utter destruction. Destruction of dignity, of life, destruction of power. By nature, it was meant to silence and shame, to rend a person into nothing but a criminal, nothing but an identifier. to obliterate the spirit, but Jesus' followers were not shamed. They were not silent. Once they got over their terror, they told his story. Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Parker said this in Saving Paradise: "The passion narratives broke silence about the shame and fear that crucifixion installed. To lament was to claim power that crucifixion was designed to destroy. Dignity and courage, love and creativity and truth-telling. In beginning to tell his story, his community remembered his name. They claimed the death-defying power of saying the name of a criminal out loud. To break silence wherever violence is used to shame, instill fear, fragment human community, or suppress those who advocate for justice is resurrection. Life is found in surviving the worst a community can imagine, in lamenting the consequences, and in holding fast to the core goodness of this world, blessed by divine justice and abundant life. The story of crucifixion and resurrection isn't a success story. The man Jesus was beaten to a bloody, miserable wreckage. They spit on him. They jammed thorns into his head. They nailed him to a stick. And no one stayed to pray or sing songs or cheer or even to watch him end. His friends ran. They left him alone with his mother. And when he made the ultimate sacrifice, which allowed the vision he had to live, he had no cheering section. He lived his values until the bitter end. The first will be last. The king will die covered in blood and sweat and curses. Following the path Jesus suggested isn't about getting to shout we're number one. It isn't about being good enough or rich enough or meeting up to some kind of standard. It isn't about exceptionality or perfection. Like Jesus' followers, it is difficult to associate ourselves with the outcast, the criminal, the poor, the reviled. We hear the stories of homelessness and poverty, addiction, crime, and human error, and we know that there, but for grace, is our face and our life. And that mirror is frightening. Our first reaction will always be to look away because no one wants to be anything but a winner. It's easy to fall asleep in that garden while someone else prays for their life. It's easy to deny you know the guy nailed to the cross, or held in the jail, or racked with cravings for drugs and alcohol. But we are them and they are us. We are humanity in all of its beauty and all of its ugliness. The death on the cross is all about our shortcomings. The crucifixion isn't about winning the rat race. It is about life stripped to the barest of bones, humanity at its most broken. Giles Frazier says this in Christianity, when properly understood as a religion of losers. He said, here's the thing, the Christian story, like the best sort of terrifying psychoanalysis, strips you down to nothing in order for you to face yourself anew. For it turns out that the losers are not despised or rejected, not ultimately. In fact, losers can discover something about themselves winners cannot ever appreciate: that they are loved and wanted simply because of who they are and not because of what they've achieved. That despite it all, raw humanity is glorious and wonderful, entirely worthy of love. Precisely at the point of greatest dejection, the resurrection is not a conjuring trick with bones. It is a revelation that love is stronger than death, that human worth is not indexed to worldly success. The triumph of the tomb is not, hooray, Jesus is holy now. It is not about achieving perfection, stripped and broken, abandoned, reviled. Humanity at its most basic ascends into glory. Everything is holy now. The shame of being less than, of losing, the crown of thorns of every mistake we've ever made, the darkness of the tombs of our failures, we can rise from all of it. Jesus was seen by his disciples after he rose, walking in the road, dressed in white robes, not hidden and bowed with shame, but triumphant. They didn't recognize him until he allowed them to feel his hands and to put their fingers in the spear wound in his side. It took a while, but they stopped running and started to tell their story. Claim your life, all of your life. Claim your worth. Tell your true story. It's beautiful. Put on your own white robe and accept that you are clean enough to wear it. Awaken to a new life. Be born again. Go further. Do not go to sleep in the garden. Do not run from the foot of the cross. Look to the poor and the criminal, the despised, the thrown away and the voiceless, to the young and the old dying in our streets, to the miserable, the underprivileged and the disenfranchised. They too are holy. They too get to wear those white robes. Make their story heard. Do not deny them. If you don't recognize them, get closer. Feel their hands. Reach for the wounds in their sides. Get your hands dirty. Make the story heard. A miracle has happened. The stone has rolled away, and the tomb is empty, and he is risen. Hallelujah. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our closing hymn this week, number 61, Lo, the Earth Awakes Again. And again, she'll play it through one time before we begin. Hallelujah. The stone has been rolled away and you are free. Rejoice, for you are risen.